Blog Talk Radio.
Sweat.
Money and got the land excavated so we could do stuff on the land. That was the first thing. So we had to get the land excavated, and then once the land was excavated, we lived in the car on the little parking lot on our land, and then saved up more money and then bought your little shack that is your work space, your woodworking room, which is that right there. Here's our neighbors. They live in a log cabin. It's our only neighbors. We're one of the few people out here full time, so like this is mostly ours, but not really. So this is your workspace, Mark, and then we lived in here for a couple weeks without air conditioning or electricity, and then that was the next thing we saved up for. We saved up to get the box turned on, and then we saved up more money and got your little workspace hooked up with electricity. And then we lived in here with electricity for probably another month or two, which was really something. It's an 8x8 building, and that was kind of nice. And then we saved up a bunch of money and got our home, which is 10x16. So here's our makeshift sink, kitchen sink. So step on this side and brush your teeth, and then when your dishes are getting dirty, you do them right here, and yeah. And oh, here's our compost pile. It's just a brand new one. We're gonna get this baby looking awesome. Not a whole lot right now. Probably been going a couple days, not very long. We'll compost our toiletries. So we have a bunch of water barrels for rain. There's two right there. Four more right there, so we just need to get a gutter system within probably the next month and start catching water instead of buying water. I think we buy like 7 gallons at a time, not very much.
You share the porch.
Okay, so this was the box spring to the bed, and then we painted it. We didn't really need the box spring because Mark built something awesome, which I'll show you. It's an old piece of art of Jesus smoking a cigarette. Okay. So this is our tiny home. This is what Mark built. This is our loft. It probably cost about $100 in wood. And then he built the staircase for me. Which has drawers, which not finished, but it will be, and then we'll put clothes in there. So you climb up here. Here, let me see that. Let me get a view. So this is the view from the bed. Have a little cubby hole and electric outlet, toys. Shitload of food. Okay, so Mark built this countertop. Show him how the countertop works. Here, just go over there and move. So that way you can access the deep freezer and the deep freezer that's converted. So that's the freezer. And then the other side is a deep freezer converted into a fridge, which there's a little conversion, which he's pointing to. There's a really cool video on YouTube on how to do that and how much electricity it saves. So Mark built all these shelves and did the insulation, the drywall, and the painting, and the wallpaper, and wallpapered the ceiling. And so, it's really cozy, like in the morning, wake up, and these are all the blinds are drawn so that the sunlight gets softened and you don't wake up to a harsh morning. what else? There's a conversion. It's maybe like a, what, like a $30 kit?
I don't know. It was like 14 bucks.
Okay. It was super cheap, and it turns this deep freezer into a fridge, and it uses about $12 in electricity a year to have your fridge. So that's good, and Mark made a bunch of shelves. What else?
Fancy couch.
Ooh, we have a fancy couch. This is good, and there's storage behind the couch, and we have a little pump organ, books, stuff like that. This has already been designated to be turned into, to be removed and turned into where we're going to put the drum kit. So we have a lot of big ambitions for this. Anything else you want to add? Yeah. Very good.
Oh, and a nice view outside.
Yeah. Nice kitchen view.
All right, there you have it. Today's podcast of Compound Living with Gail Chapman is titled Extreme Housing and Relationships, 619-768-2945 is the live stream number. And to give you a visual on that, a couple, man and wife, built a 150-square-foot tiny house, $3,000, water, just with no running water. Some people would call that extreme housing, but different strokes for different folks, but I look at it, they're both happy. So, good morning, Gail.
Good morning, Vauban. How are you?
I'm better than terrific. I wasn't even thinking about relationships in relationship to housing compounds or anything like that until you sent that other video. That's like 18 minutes long, so I didn't cue that up. But what are your thoughts on what you heard about that couple? They were in the Ozarks.
Here in the Ozarks, it was hard to imagine because I couldn't see any video. Nothing was working on this end as far as watching what they were talking about. But extreme living, I think anything smaller than what Americans are used to or people in the world are used to that have homes is going to be extreme and more difficult because we've been so trained to have lots of stuff and places to put stuff. And then more stuff comes in, so the other stuff becomes junk, and we tow it away and, you know, dump it in the dump, you know. But that's where the garbage warrior comes in, right, with the earth shifts.
Right.
And they build sustainable
which that
homes
to most people would
that.
Be extreme living.
Yes, but it's more extreme when you think about it to have something bigger than you need and that costs more than you really want to afford and that you spend most of your life working to pay off just so you can get old and then try and travel. You know what
right.
I mean?
You might not live that long.
Yeah, you might not. And the thing that's interesting is we have, I think, kind of a skewed perspective on what we actually need. I mean, do we need a commode? Yes. How many? That depends on how big your family is. Do we need showers? Yes. How often, you know, how many? Well, that depends on how big your family is. People learn to work things out. I was, you know, while I was listening to this, now I'm a realtor in Boise, Idaho, and I thought, well, look how big is the smallest home on the market in Idaho, and what are they charging for that? Because
Right.
We know, you and I know from looking at this stuff, how little people actually spend building these small, tiny, rolling houses. There's upsides to having them and downsides to having them. One of the downsides I'm seeing in real estate, if I go back to the beginning of what I found, first one I found has been on the market for one day. It hasn't sold yet. They're selling it for $44,990. Guess how big this place is.
Oh, let's see. Well, hold it. Well, how many bedrooms?
One bedroom.
One bedroom
zero
and it's in one bathroom.
Zero bedrooms, one bathroom.
Okay, and it's in the city of Boise?
No, it's in Ontario, Oregon.
Oh, I don't know anything about that. How close is that place to Portland? Or
Ontario is right next to on the border of Idaho, so that's why it's in this on our MLS here.
Okay,
that's why
I'm gonna take a what? And it's is that a rural area or suburban area or?
It from the pictures, it's in a. I can't tell what it's.
What
are
asking 44,000?
It's zoned residential, and it's got. A big lot because it's a tiny home.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big lot of 0.21 acre. So
okay. It's
almost a quarter acre this tiny home sits on. It's surrounded
I'm gonna
by
put it at maybe
other
about anywhere from 900 to maybe no more than 1,000. 1,200 square feet, somewhere between there. I'm just speculating.
You're gonna be shocked. It's 216 square feet.
For 44,000?
Yeah. And it's 51 to 80 years old. So it was built in 1946. This tiny home was built in 1946. It has, so it's like. Probably, what do they call those studio apartments which you wander in? You know, somebody puts a couch and they can turn into a bed there. And let's see, it's it has.
Well, now some people.
It has no amenities.
Okay, now it depends on who you speak to. Just based on the price tag of $44,000, that sounds like a bargain. Depends on who you speak to.
Yes.
I'm
but
spoiled.
See, what they're trying to tell us here is that without even reading the agent remarks, they're selling an investment property to build on, which means that tiny 216 square foot tiny home would just be leveled and then they'd construct something else there.
Well, that's a possible cookie cutter. That's true.
Yeah.
That's a possible cookie cutter.
The next one I found even more interesting is a place in Clearwater County in a city called Orofino, Idaho. And this one has been on the market for over a year. It has two bedrooms and one bath. It's a single family with a below grade. It was built in 1910. And they're asking $49,000 for this. And it has 696 finished square feet and about 288 unfinished square feet. So it's interesting the differences of what people, you know, the value that is placed on these things. They're not mobile homes. They're alternative livings, and to many they are extreme because people can't imagine having something smaller than what they live in. You know, and you and I have talked about this, where they have, you know, most people live in two rooms of their homes.
Right.
The kitchen and the kitchen and the bathroom. Okay, but they sleep in the bedroom, which isn't exactly living in it. That's sleeping.
Well, you don't live in your, most people don't live in their kitchen or their bathroom. You use those. So
yeah,
I guess people
so
have to define living in the rest of the house is stuff.
Yeah.
Even if you're a couple or a family, about a month ago we played the audio of the tiny house family. They were forced off the grid, and they built a 168 square foot house for four people.
And I find that amazing. And yet,
some people would call it extreme.
And some people would call it extreme. I think it just depends on perspective. Could I live in something smaller than almost 1,200 square feet? Absolutely. Because the more square footage
you
have,
think you can go?
I think the smallest I could comfortably live would probably be about 400 square feet, maybe 450.
Well, that's a small house. Not tiny, but
that's
small.
That's a small house.
Right.
But it would have to, you know.
But
you,
a lot of
I
people
would
call
to
it
be
tiny.
Really creative. Yes. That would be probably extreme for me because I have a need for my musical equipment that I use, which
takes
up space.
Well, now, what about the living to 450 square feet? And then depends on how you design it and everything. And then
exactly.
For your music stuff, you know, guitars, pianos, and all that other stuff you have, I imagine recording equipment, have another structure just for that.
That's also an idea that can be, when we talk about compound living and families.
Exactly.
Or communities of people that decide they want to live in a compound.
Well, even well,
you
can go the family the compound way or the family compound way. Or let's say you've got a quarter acre. All right, and one corner. You've got your 450 living area. And then
mm-hmm.
in a separate structure on another part of that quarter of an acre, you've got your Gail's Music Cave.
Yeah, you know, some families call them she sheds.
Call it what you want. But
you
got all your studio, you got all your musical stuff right there, and it's you might have a whole bunch of stuff because a lot of musicians I know. I got a friend of mine. He's probably got about at least 12 to 15 guitars, at least.
Yeah, and I have friends that
equipment.
Have over 50 guitars, and they
all right.
play them all, but a lot of them collect dust and, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's say you set up, you had another structure, let's say another 450 square feet. Now, let's just bump it up to 500 square feet because that's still small. You would also have, within that, you would have an area where you could teach students.
Mm-hmm.
That's another possibility.
Ultimately, the teaching and music room would probably end up being bigger than the living space or the tiny home I would build for myself. Because if I've learned anything in the process of being a homeowner and renovating it, when I initially started my own renovation, for instance, one of the things that really annoyed me about the house I've lived in forever was the lack of good storage. It just wasn't there. So I had to think about that.
No, wait, I got a question to ask you. Was it the lack of good storage or your addiction to accumulating stuff?
Probably a little of both, because I'm pretty human that way. On the other hand, I have gotten rid of a ton of stuff and still seem to have too much. So, you know, as I age, it's, you know, downsizing is always important. And what's really relevant becomes laughable at a point, because I am, you know, constantly reevaluating exactly what do I need? What do I need? So many people are even not accommodated with even a place to live anymore in the world.
Well,
let's explore, and that's
a good thing you brought up. What's the term for that? Essentialism. What are the bare, or everybody, the essentials that we need are, let's say, a roof over our head, water, not necessarily running water. And let's see, a roof over our head, water. What else is essential? And maybe a place to store food.
Power source and food.
Well, power source now. Now we're getting into the luxuries, maybe.
Not exactly, because even the cavemen had a form of power in A, sunlight, and B, fire. You know, they had to have, because if it was cold, they couldn't just survive on killing animals and throwing skins on themselves. I mean, I didn't.
Okay, so let's say you got some candles. I'm getting bare essential. All right, light.
Light is important. Natural daylight
is
even better.
I guess you need a place to lay down. Well, all right, like Walden on Golden Pond or whatever, whatever that thing was called. He lived a pretty simple life. And then, you know, but depending on the person or the household, what is essential is different from person to person or household to household.
Yes, and that's where people cross that great divide with each other or from each other that says, I can't do that. I don't want to do that. Well, there may come a time in your life when you're forced to do that. If you lose your health and you end up in like a rehab facility, they give you half a room, which is usually 150 square feet with a curtain drawn between you and the bedmate next door, you know? So, and you don't even have and you share a bathroom with a total stranger, you know?
Right.
And you hear everything that goes on. But we're talking about extreme living, but really having what you need at the same time, right?
Right. And a lot of that's different from person to person too, because you have people in relationships that are arguing over whatever their perception psychologically is of what is essential. I mean, the idea of living in 150 square feet, two people, that's not flying with most, I would say, the average American couple.
True.
Although, now, here's when I hear 150 square feet, there's no running water in that place. They have water, but no running water. Here's how I look at it. I don't have to worry about rush hour. I don't have an electric bill. I don't have a water bill. And then the heat the place doesn't cost that much on a yearly basis. That's
right.
When I hear stories like the one I played at the beginning, that's what I heard. The video that you sent me prior to the podcast today, that's how I've translated, which means that, well, what's that expression? Happy wife, happy life. So
right.
If it also translated, you know what? If I get sick or if she gets sick or whatever, you know, we don't have to worry about making a rent or nothing like that or mortgage payments and
right.
stuff like that. So that's how I look at it. But then I would probably be considered, by most people, eccentric and very extreme. And I also realize there's many people that they're addicted to consumption where no matter
definitely.
What I say or do, you're not going to pull them out of that world.
Well, it'll take a complete crashing of the economy to do that. People can't stop looking at the internet and being flagrantly fleeced by every stupid ad that comes out there for the next great thing for
$39.95. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, even before you get to the internet, if you live in a place, I haven't been to Boise yet, but I imagine if you go down to a downtown area, I know Boise is not New York City or L.A., but their temples are consumption. You know, restaurants, cafes, shopping
uh-huh.
malls. The mall is nothing but rows of temples of consumption. So you might come in there. What's the study of this called? Psychographics. Point of purchase, I fall to it occasionally. I like Reese cups. So I might go to the store, and I typically go with a short list. I go in and out. Matter of fact, I like to go shopping like 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning at best when nobody's, so I can zip in and out. But when I get to that counter, if I see a Reese cup or a Snicker bar, I'll spend a few more, one or two more dollars just stacking up on those. So, and I consider myself controlled to a high degree. But most people, they can't resist to spend that. They're in the habit of spending that whole paycheck.
And speaking
which
of malls,
affects relationships.
Yes. Now, we have a looming house crisis. As a realtor, I see this coming. Most people are not even, people are concerned, but they don't see how close this is. And I don't say this to scare people, but we have a major housing shortage across the entire U.S. right now. So thinking about downsizing is not a stupid idea, but people are still having bidding wars on homes that first-time home buyers would never be able to afford. Tiny homes and alternative living like yurts and houseboats or anything on wheels is something that people really need to start considering in the process of downsizing and give away things they don't use. Malls, for instance, I thought, malls are closing. They cannot sustain that type of shopping for people anymore because people are out of work. People don't want to go to work. They don't want to, how do you socially distance and go shopping for clothes when you can't afford the place you live in? And I thought, if these places close, malls can be repurposed.
You know what, I just thought of something. In your home state,
they can be repurposed for living.
In your home state of Minnesota, what, that's where the Mall of America is?
Yes.
How's that
doing?
I haven't heard anything about that in a while.
I don't know. I've never been to it. I just know that the ones in Boise are starting to close a lot of shops.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So.
Well, see, places like Boise, I would call a barometer of future events to happen in larger cities. Hmm.
Yeah, I have no idea. The Mall of America was a big deal, and a lot of people still go there to visit it every year. I know that.
Right.
I've never seen it. I've never been to it. I may never get to go to it, but I don't see that. I mean, I have friends that got married there, for heaven's sakes, but I can't imagine that. It's that absurd.
Yeah, like I say, it's a temple or a monument to consumption.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's got bells and whistles. It's like a Minnesota Las Vegas, in a sense, you know.
Yeah, I
shiny objects everywhere. Monkey brain takes over.
A roller coaster in there, too. But, well, now, it, all right, the, I believe that going compound living, And living sustainable, depending on how you define sustainable, within a compound landscape can, well, what's the right word? Empower, enhance. Well, wouldn't hurt a relationship. At least I don't think there'll be any fights over, because relationships are so fragile. But, and they can be complex. But I'm looking at, there won't be any fights over the electric bill, no utility bill fights, and they'll have peace of mind that they don't have to worry about a mortgage payment or a rent payment.
Yeah, I mean,
no fights in there. There might be other fights, but it won't be over those three or four items.
Yeah, I mean, I think the initial down payment for an individual structure can be reduced. I also think, you know, in the long term, cities have to start rethinking what they allow people to reclaim from the dumps in their building process.
Well,
some dumps are actually
very good topic. I mean, all right, let's think about, I don't know about how politicians are in the city of Boise, but let's take a place like Washington, D.C., I know it. Washington, D.C. and other cities, and D.C. is not real big, but it's big enough, they have unionized local government employees. Unionized employees, no matter where they are expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So where are they going to get the money to pay for that? They're going to get that from Joe or Josephine homeowner. That means the property taxes go up. And then, you know, to keep the sidewalks and all city services and a place like New York City or Los Angeles or Chicago where you have they have shelters and all these, a lot of these social programs, matter of fact, all these social programs are expensive. And those property taxes keep going up. So
the
I'm looking
only
at one
way
solution.
To re-
Go
okay.
ahead, listen.
No, I should let you finish your thought there.
Well, it.
I think we're on the same track.
Yeah, now I'm looking at, or this is why I started to buy rural acreages. I attempted to. When I had a squatter, you know, I said, well, let me get some other homeowners and landlords together so we can start a membership organization to get political. Because in a place like D.C., unless you're dealing with about $10 million on a group effort, you really can't get legislation changed and all that. And $10 million is probably a very conservative number. You know, to hire lobbyists and think.
That's
yeah.
really
so
sad.
I said, you know what? That's when I went rural. So it's a whole lot easier. It's a whole different dynamic. So different lifestyle, and then I can visit. You know, it's nice to go to a place like New York City, Chicago, you know, L.A., any great places to live, but for sustainability, not me. And in the context of this today's podcast, extreme housing and relationships, I came to realize I'm not going to talk or educate a person whose mindset and lifestyle and conditioning has been accustomed to Big Apple living. It's best to go in social circles where people are already tree huggers, if that's what you want to call
them. I've been accused of that, of being a tree hugger. In fact, just yesterday. I laughed.
Nothing wrong with those are my kind of people. I've lost friends, like the social circles that, well, I tell you what, 20 years ago or 25 years ago, I had a totally different, well, put it this way, coming out of college, I had a totally different mindset. You know, one day I'd like to own a Rolls or a Bentley and live in a big house and it. And that now, and then after different experiences and then looking at, because our parents' generation, when they moved to big cities, okay, it was sustainable. A lot of things that, let's take it, the Lever, you know, Ward and June Cleaver, that bunch, okay. Ward and June Cleaver. Essentially, I mean, June could stay home and bake cupcakes with pearls on, all right? But she can stay home. And Ward had enough money to sustain the household and probably had money left over to give the June every month, I mean, every month or every week, for herself as well as meeting the family budget for the household stuff. And he earned enough money to so they can take a family vacation. You know, in a lot of those shows, families, what fathers knows best, make room for daddy, even the Flintstones, because Wilma and Betty didn't have day jobs. Okay. So, but that stopped. And I'd say whenever the Brady Bunch came on, that was the end of that era. The end of it. Okay. So.
Yeah.
Now, so when I guess now, let's see, 20s, or when we're ready to start living on our own and buy houses and all that other stuff, okay, there were no more my mother bought her first house for $19,900. There were no more houses in that particular city for that price. Because when I started to get into real estate, it was like 1982. And started looking for houses in the area where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't find anything in my price range. Not as a single family home. And I went to all kind of open houses. It was totally out of my budget. It wasn't until I ran across outfit where they were selling income properties, duplexes, fourplexes. Then I found something within my budget. Typically, those were in what people would call today the hood. And then maybe about a year after that, after I started that way, I went to Baltimore, Maryland. And then I found, I mean, then at the time, you can like 1984, you can find houses, single-family houses, in a nice neighborhood for like $38,000. But then investment-grade property, you can find for like $15,000-$20,000. And then when I found out about foreclosures, bank foreclosures, then I was finding houses for like $20,000 or even $1,000. So that's the kind of metamorphosis that I've gone through. And then when I went to Europe and got into renewable energy, then I've, you know, hey, you know what? You don't need a utility bill, but you can have all the power that, you know, you need if you structure your house correctly and have a, so this has been a long metamorphosis, but I saw how that affects relationships and things of that nature. So you can't, it's hard to pull that off in a big city.
It is. The only way you can reduce the rising property taxes and the rising cost of housing is to build more housing for people that need housing, because right now the housing shortage has caused a boom in
where are you going to build the houses? In a place like New York City, where would you build them? New York City's already got high density.
Yeah, I know.
Well,
so they've got high density, but you know, we're not talking about New York City. We're talking about using up the suburbia farmland that is already surrounded.
Now,
we're
man,
already,
you're on the exact
about,
same page as it. You're right.
Yeah.
You've got
to
go.
New York City is kind of a lost cause when it comes
right.
to that, unless they come up with some other ingenious ways of, you know, renovating the older buildings in some of the areas, which they've already done a lot of gentrification, but it's all by doing that, they have also, you know, displaced more people.
Right.
Because who can afford it once they're gentrified? It's like, you know, and then they have, what's that area called where it's, I forget where it's called. I used to live in New York City, but it's all tenement housing and all high rise.
You're not talking about Harlem.
No, Harlem. No.
Which borough is it in?
I think it's in Queens. Harlem is part of Manhattan.
Yeah, it's part of Manhattan.
But there is a high-rise apartment complex that they put in, you know, eons and eons ago, probably 50 years ago, and a lot of people that can't afford to live in Manhattan live in that area or in that housing, and
which is
my
still, in my opinion,
that kind
sky
of
high
living. Even though it's high density, people still don't know each other. They still don't know their neighbors. They still don't talk to each other. They have gang wars. They have whatever happens because people are not communicating about the basic needs and necessities of others. There's no communication between people other than they have rules and regulations that everybody's supposed to follow, and those that don't, you know, cause trouble. But, you know, and I can see that, you know, there's a basic misperception, and this could be just me talking out the back of my head here, but high-rise living, just because it's affordable, doesn't mean that it's good. On the other hand, if it is designed for community purposes, more like a compound that we've been talking about, then high-rise living can, with some amenities that humans need. I mean, they need activity. They need they need membership and community. They can't just have, you know, hallways, endless hallways with apartments that separate everybody, where nobody knows what's going on, nobody meets, nobody has a social order. You know, they have HOAs. I know they do. But it's not designed for human functionality. I mean, the whole thing about people, you know, moving out to the grasslands or the woods or something is a great idea. But even so, you might have a great view and you might like the peace and quiet for a while, but eventually you got to go to town. Eventually you have to have human interaction, and it can't just be with the people you work with, you know.
Well, you can have human interaction. I mean, there are a bunch of towns around the United States that have a population of, let's say, 400 people or less. Some have 100 people or less.
And there's nothing extreme about those situations. They live in nice homes. You know, home is what you make it.
Right.
I'm never going to walk into somebody's home and go, ew, why do you do that? It's none of my business why they do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's none of their business what I think about what they do. You know, the idea of what's relevant to somebody in a small town and what's relevant to a person who doesn't live in that town or lives in a bigger city becomes apparent, but there are still basic necessities that they all need. They all need a roof over their head. They need a place to hang their clothes and sleep at night and get up and do what they do in the morning and have a functional life. I'm not saying everybody should live with just the bare necessities, but really I think we would have a lot less waste. We would have a lot less debt. We would have a lot less problematic society problems if simplicity were taught, if more basic things were continued to be stressed.
I agree.
You know, churches, for instance. When did the mega churches come into existence? And what was their purpose, really?
Good question.
And
because you see
why?
A mega church, typically somebody's driving a Rolls or a Bentley.
I know. And that's not about anything but whatever it is that they're thinking about.
And those churches
like,
typically don't...
they don't help people.
They don't teach... All right. Like some of them have teach the prosperity ministries or whatever. Now my definition of prosperity is different from their definition of prosperity. Mine's based on simplicity, and I believe the simpler and smaller you live, the larger you can live. I mean, really live. I mean, go see friends, be in relationships with people that you really want to be in relationships with, because there's many people that live, let's say a New York City or even a Chicago or something like that, that, you know, they're basically roommates there for financial reasons exclusively. And they're sleeping in the same bed, cringing every night. Yeah, I wouldn't want to live that way.
And here you have this idea of abundance. Well, what is true abundance? Even Jesus Christ was one that said, I wish that you would live more abundantly, but realm as well as in having what you need, because he always promised, you know, that he'll supply all our need, not our greed.
Right,
but
I think he's a good example of abundant. I think he's a good example of abundant living through simplicity. Cause
exactly.
At least from the New Testament, okay, number one, he didn't have a mortgage payment to pay. Or rent payments.
Well, how do we know
he
that?
Was a carpenter. So the two things I'm the three things I'm looking at with him that I consider prosperous, was number one, he had a skill set, a portable skill set. He was a carpenter. Now, what kind of a carpenter he was, I don't know. But I'm pretty sure that if he needed to put together a tiny house or whatever, he could do it. Number two, he had a lot of social capital. So he can go to somebody's place and be put up for the night or be put up for the week or whatever. And number three,
they also made a habit of that.
Right. Well, social capital. I mean,
right.
Because if you look at it, if you look at it from that, and then every miracle that he performed didn't, it was based on social capital. It, imagine if you wanted to feed 5,000 people in today's world, somebody, you know, well, use these government issued, you know, dollars or euros or yens or rubles. Back then, and even now with the Amish community, the Amish community basically to a very high degree, they operate off of social capital. Now, they have their farmers markets where they trade their furniture, their apple pies or dinners for dollars because, you know, they live in this particular country and economy. But
uh-huh.
a lot of the Amish couples or Mennonites, they go from their parents' house to their own home because they get together as a family or community with that social capital and build homes that are basically debt-free. They've cut out the middleman. They've cut out the real estate agent. They cut out the title company. They cut out they've cut a whole lot of people out just by social capital.
That is a great concept as well. Not that we should cut all those people out because there is, I mean, not everybody's going to live by those types of social standards. And what I mean by that is their religious community and what they believe in, how they administer their own justice among each other. I don't know, so I don't have any comment about that, but I do know that outside of those communities, there is still a need for rules, regulations, and the rule of law because we have the lawless side that will take advantage of and hurt people otherwise. So, but I understand exactly what you're saying about the social, what was your term? The social?
Social capital.
Social capital, yeah. I think it's something that needs more developing outside of those types of communities. I mean, we have chambers of commerce, but they support other businesses. They don't necessarily support communities of people or the church, for that matter.
Well, hold on, Gail, let me play this, and this is a good example of social capital.
Say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned, and the yard, the grass, high as hell and everything. There's a couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars these is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back at the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pull up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, "What y'all finna do?" He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. Wow. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Whew. It was an abandoned fucking house.
and it looked new this morning.
It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow.
You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15.
That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family gonna live in there? Is they gonna, I'm gonna get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
Well, that's an urban example of social capital.
Yeah, that is awesome. I think that is the way things should get done, too. But, you know, getting people to get off their butts and away from their televisions and work together like that is really tough. Again, it goes, there's only a few examples I can think of, and they aren't exactly what most people would want building at 7:15 p.m. till dawn the next morning. You know, but there are outfits of people that will do that. And most of them are of the conventional strategies that are expensive and don't work for most of the people.
Yeah, I think most people that outside of a culture, or even within a culture, that do something like that, and matter of fact, if we go back 150 years or so, or had to look at the history of man, particularly as civilization expanded in certain areas of the globe. Let's say you're on a wagon trail or whatever in the wilderness,
uh-huh.
You and your family. You've got to work together. So we've got our forefathers, they didn't have the couple of inconveniences that we have today. There were no shelters to go to. There were no government programs. So you have, like I say, if you look at the history of housing, where people knew how to forage for food, how to catch food and all this other stuff, and how to make temporary shelters from dugouts to tree houses to whatever, with sticks and branches or whatever. You know, the husbands and wives and the kids, they didn't have time to argue about all that. It's like nightfall is coming. We need to do this. We got so many hours of daylight this time of year in this climate. So that's how it came together. Now, in today's world, like we played the audio about 4 weeks back, the Tiny House family, they had the lost jobs, lost their home. So they had to go to Craigslist, and the husband and wife, they kept it together and cooperated and used, Craigslist as a gold mine to build that $11,000, 168 tiny house. So if it happens today, I think people are being forced into it.
Yeah, maybe. But here's the upside that I can think of right off the top of my head is that with so many millions of people out of work, work is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And even if it's a labor position, not that it should be hard labor, like, you know, nothing like the Nazis were doing, but if it means that they are working to build communities, I think it's a plus.
Now, let's. What's your minimum threshold definition numerically for a community?
Can you expound on that idea? I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, let me give an example. A lot of the time, well, you take the town of Houston, Texas. Houston, Texas started out with, I would call it a community of three people, two brothers and a wife. Now, probably over 1 million people live in Houston, or at least the metro area. But it started with just three people. And most towns, started with small amounts of people, like Eatonville, Florida, which is about 45 minutes from where I'm at in Florida. It started out with actually one person, Joe Clark, who was born a slave. He bought maybe 50 acres of land. But in order to get more land, he had to partner up with 26 other people, most of which were born slaves, too. And they started the town of Eatonville, Florida, which is about 6 miles outside of Orlando, Florida. So most towns in the United States, probably globally, started with just a handful of people, mostly family members or friends of families, and they purchase a piece of land or squat on a piece of land, depending on what part of history that you want to explore. And that's how a lot of towns were started. So as an example of the number, I guess if you 1 to 3 people, or let's say 2 to 3 people, I think is probably would be, from my point of view, a community.
Yeah, well, okay. So I think
it's
I understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
That's bare bones because you have to be able to have this level of skill. You know, so at least one person has to have the knowledge, and the other two have to have capable hands and strength to help, if not some of the same knowledge and understanding of the project, of what it is they're going to build. Compound living in extreme situations, whether it's on the outskirts of town or in the wilderness or wherever people choose to do something like compound living, there has to be a level of understanding between all of them where they understand what they're doing, why they're doing it. Because it's the why that's more important than the how, I think, when it comes to why people get together and even commence with these types of ideas.
Yeah, you're right. The why is the most important part. As a matter of fact, there's an Amway tape that I've been a guy named Bill Britt. He's passed over, but he had a motivational tape called The Why, which basically he talks about what you just said. If you got a strong why, the how will take care of itself.
That's true. If you have a strong why, that's he's not the only one who has said that. I mean, I can name several, like Darren Hardy and Jim Rohn and Dale Carnegie. If you have or Robert Kiyosaki, all of them. You know, if you have a strong why, the how will take care of itself, and it's very true. People have to continue seeking until they find who, not necessarily what, but who they can work with, because community is a working entity. Citizens are people that work together or not, but a community has an understanding of why they are where they are and for what purpose. So in simplifying neighborhoods and HOAs and community standards, I think we're going to see some drastic changes in the next 5 years and in the next 20 and 50 when it comes to housing. people have to be more involved in why they want to live somewhere, as opposed to can I afford it or not? Because that's not going to be the issue anymore. I mean,
well,
when you think about how to go ahead.
Go ahead, I'm listening. Well, now I was getting to a person's why. Let's say a person, for whatever reason, they had their why. Because it's an idea you brought up last week or the week before last. What the idea that you brought up, I look at as a how to complicate, I mean, not to complicate, to complement somebody's why. I know my why. And that is putting together a backyard workshop where you're teaching people how to build, and actually you can actually use it as a you can throw an element of the compound and the community and all that stuff all within a backyard. And there's a whole bunch of backyards all over the place. So any thoughts on that? Because we haven't talked about that aspect of it. You've got a backyard. I've got a few backyards. So, but you only need one backyard
to
start.
I used to have a couple backyards, but not anymore.
Backyard, you know, you start off with one backyard. So were you able to do any research on, in your neck of the woods, what it would if you need a permit for, like, I mean, what's the threshold where you need to get a permit to build something? Not a permanent structure, but just something that you can build and take down.
You need a my memory. I believe it's over 800 square feet. You need permits. If you're going to have sewer connected, you need a permit. So if you're building a structure in your backyard, if it's a shed and it's on a slab, even though it's permanent, usually, you know, there's no plumbing and no electricity to it. But if you wanted to build a shop, you need to pull a permit because you have to supply electricity.
We're talking about Peter King style. So we're talking about under 800. You said 800 square feet?
I think that's what it is, but I have to double check. In fact,
okay.
I'm in front of my computer, so while we're talking, I'll just look.
All right. Well, let's scale it down. Right, the couple that we played at the beginning of the podcast, they did 150 square feet with no running water, but that's in the Ozarks. So we're talking about rural Arkansas, Missouri. And maybe a tiny bit of, I think they did this in Arkansas, though. And then I've known of people that have built 60-foot structures. And the most important thing is you can't call it a house, because the moment you call it a house, then you've legalized yourself. You've married yourself to the building code.
Okay, here is what it says. Standalone structures that exceed 200 square feet in area require a building permit. And that's the homeowner's guide, City of Boise.
Oh, that's liberal then. So you can do something 150, 180 square feet. Because I know some people that consider anything from 100 square feet and up, they consider it luxury.
So a building permit is required when the wooden deck or concrete patio is more than 12 inches above grade.
Okay.
An erosion or sediment control permit is required when 10 cubic yards or more of earth is disturbed at a site. Contractors required to obtain an ESC permit must have an ESC responsible person certification. Homeowners doing the work are exempt from certification requirements. Whew, boy. Driveway, no building permit is required, but you need planning and zoning approval.
We're talking about constructing a structure. I'm not even going to put a label on it.
Okay.
That's not a permanent structure.
Okay, a garden shed. It says if located in a floodplain, a permit is required. A permit is not required as long as the structure is 200 square feet or less. If the structure is over 120 square feet and less than 200 square feet, you need to confirm your property setbacks with the planning division.
Well, it's obviously got to be under 200 square feet then.
Yeah.
So, all right, well, that means something can be put up for demonstration purposes without a concrete, you know, without a making it permanent on a slab that can be constructed in the weekend to teach people the basic, let's say, carpentry skills.
Mm-hmm.
And then it can be deconstructed, or it's up to the homeowner, really, what they want to do with it. Will it end up a man cave, she shed, studio, glorified doghouse, dollhouse, Ken and Barbie house? A whole lot of things you can call it.
Yeah. I mean,
don't call it a house.
Anything. Yeah, for anything else, plumbing permits are required for most bathroom remodels when fixtures are replaced. Electrical permits are required when electrical fixtures are added, such as required smoke alarms when a building permit is required.
And that's
mechanical
on the grid electrical appliances.
Yeah. Mechanical permits are required when vents and ducts are added, replaced, or relocated. This includes dryer vents, range hood vents, and extending heating ducts, adding registers, or replacing furnaces and air conditioning units. Wow. They really.
Now, you know what? Listening to you read all that, I'm here's the visual I have on that. The lobbyist who sat down and dictated what the legislators, you know, here the lawmakers write this. The lobbyist was paid by the union people who were paid by contractors who install all that stuff. Because if we let's go back in the time machine, let's go back to Abraham Lincoln's time, okay. Vents, ducts, electrical, it's a whole bunch of stuff now that didn't exist then. But you can still build simple now and go solar and just be totally off the grid. Because with the Lamar Alexander audio I played a few weeks ago, he's got power. He's got electric power. He uses solar. But he doesn't have – but his power isn't guided by what's written in what you just wrote. I mean, not wrote, but read.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, saying all that to say is going back to the backyard. Okay, teaching people how to build sustainable housing using your backyard. Well, you can monetize that and I think make out pretty well.
That's what I'm working on
this end. Yeah. Because you got a backyard near. How many people have backyards in your neighborhood?
Everybody.
Now, is everybody, what, 40 people, 100 people, or what?
Households. Let's see. Households, I have, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25. There's probably 25 to 27 homes on this block.
Okay, and all have backyards. So let me put this
and
in.
Which means I have room for probably 4 or 5 tiny homes just on in my backyard alone if I wanted to build them.
Right. Now, well, I'm not going to get into the politics of the zoning and all that. But let's put this, because I'm trying to monetize this. All right, let's say you came up with a backyard workshop teaching people this, where let's say you netted $1,000 in your pocket. All right, now, taking a page out of Airbnb, that backstory is they were living in San Francisco in a 3-bedroom apartment facing eviction. So they decided to rent out their bedrooms with air mattresses, thus the name Airbnb. That strategy worked where they were able to keep, you know, get caught up on their back rent and not get evicted. And they were making about, like, maybe $200 a week during that, $800 a month. It was like that for a long time until somebody told them, why don't you just take that idea and then do it in other parts of the city? And then other properties, and then they got an app together, and then it's the rest is history there in over 65,000 cities across the globe. So what I'm saying is the same thing they did with Airbnb, and those guys are like 30, 38, somewhere around those ages, today. You can do the same thing with backyards. Just start with one, the one you have, and see how that works, and then let the universe go.
Well, that would be a good reason. That would be a good reason to have you come to Idaho and teach some of your background and history on some of this as well. So.
All right. Well, we'll do it. And matter of fact, even before I get there, because we've got the technology.
Yes.
We both have internet connections. We both have,
yes.
I'm on Zoom as well as StreamYard.
Yes.
And I got a backyard here. So, and I've got 4 acres in another place. So, on our off time or maybe the next podcast, plan out, because it can be just something really, really simple. And like you know, when I come out there, it's matter of fact, that'll pay for the way to come out there. So, and Idaho, I haven't been there yet, but I imagine it's easier to do things there than it is. Idaho has a lot of rural area. That's the key. That's what I'm looking at. It's got a lot of rural area. Will I be able to pull it? We be able to pull this off in Boise? I'm not looking at Boise. I look at Boise the same as I would look at Chicago. It's not going to work. I might be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, we are in a systemic glut problem right now, like many cities are.
Right.
We have a lack of housing. We have a need for more housing. We have people complaining about where the new housing is going to be built and who's building it.
Right.
And, you know, it's like, shut up. We need more housing and we need to support it. Because otherwise, if you don't like your property taxes now, just wait till another year passes and we've done nothing.
And they're going to go
now,
up. So, yeah. I believe we can do something in a backyard in Boise or any other place, and where you got the city dwellers that are looking for solutions, because even before the pandemic, you got matter of fact, even going back to these 50s TV shows, Lucy and Ricky, Lucy was always coming, half of her schemes were trying to find ways to make money. So, you have people that are looking for ways to live more sustainable. Some people, hey, they might get an Amway. I don't know if they still have that, but Amway, Mary Kay, you know, what's on the internet. Somebody sent me something. I got a Texas warning from somebody on gifting. You know, you bring in $500 and you get to, I'm not a multi-level marketing person myself, but teaching them the basics of in a person's backyard on how to get at least dramatically reduce, if not eliminate, that mortgage payment or rent payment, and where to do it and how to do it. There's a market for that, and like I said, people are looking right now. They're always looking. I look at it that way.
Well, one option for me would be to build my own tiny house in the backyard, get rid of all my stuff, and move in there, and then sell the house and the lot and rent from the new owners.
Or build the tiny house, move out of the build the tiny house in the backyard. Then do workshops to pay for it, and then keep the house, but rent the house out.
Yeah, that
just another cookie
heart.
Cutter. Just another cookie cutter.
Yeah. It's a cookie cutter I just happen to have lived in for the last 24 years. But, plus I've done a lot of work on the inside that makes it a lot less cookie cutter. So.
Oh, okay.
And it's one of those things. If I move, I want to move away and let somebody else do what they're going to do. So hopefully what I've done is a good start for somebody else to make it even better. Not just come in and let renters come in, because renters, in my opinion, they're good people, but it's not their house. And if something breaks, they're not going to fix it, and they rarely tell the landlord about it. It's a sad situation. I don't look down on renters, but I do know that it's different when you're renting. I've never had a renter take care of a place the same way an owner would.
No, that you're right. Yeah, in most cases, you're absolutely right. Anyway, Gail, what we're going to do is give out the information where people can contact you, and then we'll call it a wrap.
Okay. Well, I've enjoyed today's discussion. Thank you. We covered a lot. My name's Gail Chapman, and I live in Boise, Idaho. I am brokered through Silver Creek Realty Group. I am a buyer and seller rep, and I love helping people in whatever way I can. I do a lot of research, and I love talking with Vauban Schwartzbold because he's very knowledgeable in the tiny home and the compound and the earthship living stuff. And the more I learn, the more intrigued I am. So life is good, and it's a great place to keep learning as long as you're alive.
Yeah, we didn't really touch on the relationship aspect of it. Got sidetracked. Yeah, because everybody's not cut out for a lot of the stuff that we talk about. But that's okay.
That's true. That's okay.
And if some people are exposed to the idea, I know, like, when I got introduced to sustainable living, I was over in Europe living in a situation where I was immersed into it and I didn't really have any choice. I wouldn't call it extreme these days. I mean, for what I know now. But for me, it was I adjusted to it, and I remember one time I went out, friend came by, he owned the bar, and it was cold. This is Germany. Ice cold. But he needed somebody to help him chop wood, because that's how he doesn't have any utility bills, but that's why in the wintertime, because he would chop his own wood. So he needed some help. So we spent the day, and it was a cultural, what do you call it? A cultural adjustment for me. And I didn't need a membership to the gym that day, because chopping wood is a workout.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Because you got to look at my background. Yeah. Yeah, growing up in an urban environment where you flick a switch for heat.
Yeah. Yep. I hear you.
Now, prior to him doing that, I went through like a minor, what I call a minor culture adjustment, because we slept in a nice, I guess you would call it a condo over here, where a stove, you know, but it was, you know, it's Europe and it's, the aesthetics are, you know, cool looking. So I got used to, I mean, I'm the one that had to learn how to put the wood in and clean it out and all this other stuff. So that wasn't too far of a gap, cultural gap.
Uh-huh.
And the place was warm and no heating bill. Zero. Okay. And but then when he came by, like I said, that day we went, he said, "How many sandwiches do you want?" I said, "Well, I'll have two." This for the whole day. And then, I mean, gave me an axe, and I was chopping. And we spent about a good 6 hours out there chopping stuff down.
And
two I
sandwiches
was drenched
became four.
With sweat. Huh?
I said two sandwiches just wasn't enough by the end of the day, right?
No, I came back because I was drenched. Dressed with sweat, as cold as it was, but I didn't mind it because it was a real workout. Came home, stripped those clothes off, took a shower, and got into bed. But it was an experience that I wouldn't trade for the world, though. Because I'm looking at it, because once again, he didn't have any. That's how he. You know what, but see, it was a little place called Crailsheim, Germany. About 32,000 people lived there. But many people in that part of Europe, that's what they do. That's part of their lifestyle. There is no heating bill because they, over here in green circles, they call it biomass. So what will burn? Will it be wood, rye, stuff that burns that you can get out of nature that's renewable. I met a couple of people at this bar. As a family, they would buy like what they call forest, and they would buy it simply so the family would have plenty of wood for building, heating stuff, cooking, and all that. Now, where I lived at, we went to the sawmill and just bought scraps like every 6 or 7 weeks, we bought scraps and put them in the back of the van, and then take it back and put it in the cellar. And you know, when you needed more heat, you know, you just come up with that type thing. So, and it's like in 5 years, not one heating bill. In Germany, it gets really cold.
That's
so
pretty amazing. For people that live in Minnesota, Maine, Vermont, that kind of stuff should be taught. You know, all those northern New York, upstate New York.
Right.
No reason not to incorporate some of these ideas because they aren't new.
Well,
I mean,
you know, we're going
right
to include
this.
We're going to include this type of teachings in the this Idaho thing we're going to put together, the backyard thing, because one of the epiphanies I had when I first got into this type of stuff over there was, because I was a landlord at the time too, over here in the States. And I finally, you know what, because when a tenant, I had units where they were self-contained. Tenants had to pay their own electric bills and heating bill to the respective companies. I wasn't concerned about that. All I wanted was my rent money. But then after living over there in Europe and going through this cultural difference, I said, you know what? If I need to think about the sustainability of the unit Because if they can't afford to live, the last person who's going to get paid is the landlord and or the bank. So you need to make sustainable. And that was my why. And then I saw how Lincoln
relationship. And that's precisely where we are now, because people can't pay their rent. Landlords can't pay their mortgage. And people are, you know, I've read some of these comments on Facebook that people are saying, well, you're just a greedy landlord. I mean, I don't feel bad for you at all. And it's like, well, you're going to feel bad. You're going to feel better because they're going to sell it to a management company that's going to kick you out and raise the rent. So where's that going to put you?
Right. And the management company and the landlords, for the most part, don't know anything about sustainability. Anyway, we're out of time. So before Blog Talk kicks us off, we're going to go out with Gail's theme. Gail, we'll speak later.